Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom, where wisdom comes from everywhere. This is a podcast about generational wisdom shared to help build a bridge for future generations and to build stronger communities through education, technology, and health. Welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Hola, hola, comunidad, and thank you for joining us today. Again, your support is always appreciated in listening to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. So what does it mean today to live in a new digital era of AI strategies and ChatGPT? We're hearing AI is in everything and also ChatGPT. The information that lives within the internet is now decades old, and I've said this before, and it is coded by those who had and still have most of the access today. So who is this AI technology race for exactly? As I've mentioned in my episode 42, we have to understand the lens from which we are fed information back to us through our phones, through our computers, through the algorithm. And how do we learn as a community to build new pathways to access these capabilities and to also educate ourselves and the communities of the future about these new technologies? Can technology today be truly available to everybody? As globally, it is not 100% accessible. And can we afford it? Can we afford not to have it today? Welcome to today's episode, where we have the privilege to explore the intersection of social justice, information science that is behind the technology and the power that community holds with this information. So my guest today is Fatima Espinoza Vasquez, a PhD and assistant professor at the University of Kentucky, where she is part of the College of Communication and Information School of Information Science. I met Fatima at Latina Futures back in January of 2024, where we were talking about policy for technology. Fatima will share with us her dedication to leveraging information and communication technologies for positive social change, which has sparked conversations for me and her to discuss our usage over social media usage, AI for business, and also for political misinformation, which we know will be happening in the months to come. This is a critical year for us to understand how we can utilize the power of technology and to help those and others in our community to understand what is true from false narratives or what is AI generated as deep fakes. Our voices are powerful. So this is a vehicle in which I leverage this platform for my guests to bring their knowledge and their expertise in the arenas that many of us do not have access to or know where to find. Or better yet, how can we collectively change the dialogue for social good? So let's be good trouble today and welcome to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. Welcome, Fatima, to Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. You know, my experience in seeing the panel at Latina Futures at UCLA in January about policy making in technology and media, seeing you and a few of these women talking about technology, and the room was packed, right? There was not a seat available. People wanted to know what is going on with policy, law, and technology. And that's why I have you on this podcast today, to share a little bit about the knowledge where you say you want to fuel positive change and advocate the accessibility to those striving for social justice. So welcome today, Fatima. And tell us a little bit about your background.
Hi, Theresa. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. Yeah, so I'm actually recently promoted to associate professor. So I got a PhD in information science and technology from Syracuse University. And then I came to work to the University of Kentucky to the School of Information Science. And so I am an associate professor here now. As a professor, you know, you teach a lot, but you more than 50% of your responsibilities, at least in my case, is to also do research. So I research our communities. I research about particularly Latinx and marginalized communities and how we use information and communication technology to move ahead, to address our problems, to address our information needs. I am originally from Honduras, and I came to the United States almost 20 years ago. Time flies. So to study, and first I got a master's, and I work a little bit, and then I did my PhD. But I've always been interested in technology. I am thankful to my mom, who worried a lot about us, you know, having access to a computer when we were kids, and that sort of basically paved the way for me to lose fear of, you know, being in front of a computer and playing around with it. And I started working with a little bit web design and back home in Honduras. And that gave me also the opportunity to work for the U.S. government back in Honduras. I worked for a few years for the American embassy. I was the web designer over there. And actually, I was in the embassy working during 9/11. And I worked at the public affairs section. And I remember that it was very confusing. And I remember that they let everyone go from, you know, home. And the public affairs section had to stay because we needed to handle the information, update the website, update journalists. So it was quite an interesting time to be working there. Yeah. So, and through all this time, you know, that for me, the common theme is, you know, the managing of information, understanding how important information is. And so I decided I wanted to continue to work on this area.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine at the time, I remember for all of those folks, youngins out there, I want to say 9/11 was a turning point on information and immigration, right? Which is still happening today. And there's a lot of a narrative, right, that gets spun up by media. So now that we're talking about politics in a way of the narrative and the story, we have a big election year. You know, every year is a big one, but this is like the major one. And why is that? Well, because of the narrative that we talk about, and social media plays a big part of that. So when you started getting into information sciences to get your PhD, my question to you is, you know, social media wasn't even really in its full, like, blown, you know, even the iPhone wasn't even around yet. You know what I mean? The iPhone changed everything. So tell me, like, what was your quest in being in information sciences when you came over from the embassy, you know, that point managing information to where you wanting to gain that doctorate in information sciences?
So it's really interesting. My journey has been very similar to the evolution of theories in information and technology. So I parted from a pretty deterministic perspective about technology, the role of technology in society. So I used to think that technology can solve everything and that technology is the answer for everything, right? And so as I started, and because it opened a lot of doors for me, being able to design a website and being able to manage databases and things like that. But as you start getting more engaged with the history, the literature on the history of information technology, the literature of information technology, and the different perspectives about what the role of information technology has in society, you start to have a more nuanced approach. And in my case right now, it's a very complex approach to information technology. So I became a little bit more critical, right, about technology. I became aware of things like the idea of social construction of technology, which I love to reference, which is basically the idea that technology takes the shape of the values and the principles and the roles of those who have the capacity to manipulate it. Right. And so as you start learning that who and you wonder who has access to these technologies, who has access to the capacity to learn to manipulate technology, and you start learning that there are power relations involved. Right. And so you become a little bit more critical of the technologies themselves and also of the systems and the people who create those technologies. Right.
100%. Yeah, and I think it was radio, television, and that was where we got our facts. We saw it and it was in our minds made true, right? It's the visual piece, right? So I'm leading the question here. So now students today are asking the same questions, I think, through your class about data. Is it real? Where does it come from? Maybe. But it's like the people that are in rural areas that have no access, how do they begin to be a part of the conversation when they have them? I feel they have the most history to leverage knowledge. That's my own kind of backstory a little bit, but that's part of what I'm asking for you in the classroom. Like, what are the students asking related to this information society that's through technology?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So first, yes, regarding the idea that you just mentioned about technology, radio and TV being our main media, right? So that was absolutely the case. And so one interesting characteristic about those type of technologies is that very few people had access to those. So for you to have a radio station, right, was very difficult. You had to have the money, you had to have, you know, follow regulations and so forth. And then so we had a few mediators, right, in that sense. So those who had access to their station were the mediators of our information. So with the internet, that changed. And so we have a huge amount of mediators, right? And so that, yeah, that changed a lot. And so being able to sort of track that has been part of my journey. And so, however, going back to the idea of the digital inequity that you just mentioned in rural areas and so forth, which is something I want to touch upon in a little bit again, is the fact that the radio and TV still continue to be very important, particularly in areas where there is not enough access to the internet. So that's something that we can think about. Now, the other, and so following that has been very interesting. Basically, yes, we have in our lifetime witnessed this huge change, right, of, you know, how information is managed. And that's why we have sub-disciplines in information science about, you know, information retrieval, information seeking, and so forth. So to try to understand that, even though those disciplines come from way, way, way back, but now they're looking into the digital world. So it's a huge universe, really, right, to try to understand that.
Right. It really is amazing how we curate information. I mean, this goes back, like, you know, centuries, right? If we want to talk about, like, scribes and, you know, hieroglyphics and, you know, things of that nature, right? How we kept track. But the thing is, like, who is in charge of that narrative, right? Who gets to tell the story, right? Like Hamilton, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? I just quoted Hamilton right there.
Right. And so the technology has given us the information technology, the digital information technologies have given us the ability to create so many different communities, right? And these communities have their own mediators and their own gatekeepers and so forth. So it's quite complicated. And like I said, there's a whole subfield in information science that looks at that stuff. So it's a lot. Now, regarding the rural access and so forth, the one thing that I would like for us to think about today is the idea of what we used to call digital divide. We now think of it more of in terms of digital inequity, because we are not only bounded. So the digital divide was bounded by regions and by countries usually, or by, yeah. But if we think about it, in metropolitan areas, we also have digital inequity, right? There are people who still don't have access. So I want us to think about, yeah, this gap in access, more of a structural social problem. And in many ways, that's how I approach my research, looking at technology and the issues around technology as a social structural problem. So, and again, that's one thing that I wanted to sort of for us to think. But in terms of what students are asking, because that was your original question, whether they're asking these things. So part of my job, and I try really hard, is for them to try to see that there is this interrelation between society, policies, institutions, technologies and the way they are behaving, the way they are using technology, and so forth. So it's very complicated, and eventually they start to, you know, to understand, to get it. But they usually come with this very deterministic notion about technology. And so having them think about it critically is quite some work. I mean, it took me decades, right, to understand this. So for them, I hope I'm at least planting the little seed, because it's crucial. It's super important for them to start questioning, you know, those things. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the difference between the digital divide and digital inequity, right? What do you think is the difference between the digital divide and digital equity when corporate America is really driving that narrative? Because everybody can have access, but they don't, right? Biden gave a little bit of a stipend for low-income families, and now that's going away. So can you expand upon that a little bit?
So from my perspective, the digital divide is a term, I think, that emerged from all of those studies that the United Nations was doing in the early 2000s, right? To figure out how do we get third world countries, quote unquote, right? Third world countries have these countries become developed, right? And so the problem with that perspective, even though it has good intentions and that's not enough. The problem with that perspective is that it places the fault on the user, the consumer, or the country in this particular case, right? And so it lacks complexity. And so other researchers started thinking about, okay, what are really the causes? So the causes of the digital divide, there were theories about that it was a geographic reason, or it was the type of government. But researchers found that there is a relation between other factors and access to technology that are race, gender, immigration status in some places, and economic status, right? So the term that defines better the lack of access is inequity, because it's not just inequity in the access to information, but it's related to other types of inequities. And so there's a concept called precarity, which basically explains that certain groups of people live in vulnerability and they experience constantly insecurity in all areas of their life. And so this interconnectedness is what is at the root of digital inequity. So if you have digital inequity, that means that you probably are marginalized in other areas as well, right? So I think that would be the difference. So in terms of the commercial aspect and why is it called that way, I think it's because it's more simple to blame, you know, those who don't have the access as ignorant people who don't have access to who don't have the skills to manage technology and so forth. One of the other problems is that there is a motive for profit as opposed to another motive, right? So I think the intentions of corporations are always going to be mediated by that. So just to give you an example, I participated in a study long time ago when I was doing my PhD with a professor, and she was looking at how rural communities in Argentina created their own infrastructure for cell phone networks. And they did it through cooperatives. And these were funeral, it's very interesting. They created funeral cooperatives like to bury their loved ones, right? So they would gather the money and have the money, you know, set as a cooperative to bury their loved ones. And then when cell phones started coming in, they're like, okay, we have this money here. Maybe we can also start using it to build, you know, our cellular network, because the corporations won't come here, right? They were calling for a long time these companies to come and have cell phone service, and they didn't, because they didn't consider it a good investment, right? Because it was too much investment for the amount of people in the towns. And I don't quite remember the details, but it was something like the law would allow them to use the actual infrastructure that the cooperatives have made, right? So these cooperatives were addressing their problem on their own. However, you know, corporations didn't see it as a problem because it was not profitable, right? I guess it's entirely different perspectives about things, right?
Yeah. Well, I want to bring up another study, right, that you participated in. I think you actually authored it, was the Hurricane Maria. You want to talk about people coming together and just kind of doing it for themselves, right? Which is something I'm a big advocate of. You know, it's like tech isn't going to save you. Corporations, you know, don't wait for the door to open. If you have the skill set, the people, the knowledge, whatever it is to take, just try to do it yourself, right? Because something wonderful can come out of it. So I just saw that you have a research study from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico about that. And can you expand upon that research study? Because I found it very interesting, even though I couldn't read the whole thing. But you're talking about the same thing that was very relevant not too long ago.
Yeah, so this is very interesting. And I think this is the reason why I have gotten into this area of research, because we have always in information science and technology, we have always assumed that, you know, there's a digital divide or there's a digital inequity because communities don't know, because they don't have the skills, because there's something wrong going on with them, right? And as I started, you know, moving along and collecting my own data with my studies, and reading a lot of the literature, really, is that we need to acknowledge that that's not true. Communities have a lot of knowledge already. That communities have agency to take their own, to take matters into their own hands, right? So it was with this perspective and also with the very complex approach that I take to these studies. We looked at, and I'm going to get a little academic here, like 3 levels of analysis. I looked at the macro level, which is laws, regulations, and institutions. I look at what I call a meso level, which is organizations, how they behave, you know, what kind of practices they adopt. And then the micro level is the shared understandings that these people have. So I go into a case and I looked at all this stuff. So in the case of Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, we all witnessed in the news how, you know, FEMA was failing, the local government was being ineffective, and how actual small communities and activists were being way more effective, right? Like, we all saw that in the news. And one of the things that these people at the micro level, which is the common understandings, is that this is something that they had in common, all these organizations or these people who got organized. They had in common that they did not believe the government of any kind was going to help them because it had not helped them in the first place. They all had the awareness that Puerto Rico is a colony of the U.S. and as such, you know, they're being treated as second-class citizens. And so that's what they had in common, right? So that was at the micro level. They're all are aware of this. They're all are aware of the power dynamics that are behind, you know, their political system. They're all aware of inequities. And many of them were anti-capitalist. So they have an anti-capitalist approach to doing whatever they do. So there were these different kinds of activists. So that we had people with community kitchens, we had people who were environmental activists, people who were promoting solar energy, women's rights activists, and so forth, right? So all these kinds of organizations. And so I was trying to figure out, okay, what made them effective, right? Because it was a huge amount, like I think it was like 80%, it's my own paper, but I don't even remember, the 80% of the infrastructure, the telecommunication infrastructure was destroyed, right? And so this is the communication, the information technology aspect of it. Like, there is no such thing. And then how did they do it? And so I looked at the macro level. Okay, what are the environmental political conditions? Well, it's a colony. The regulations that they have are the United States regulations to function, to do everything. Some stuff is even in English when most people in Puerto Rico speak Spanish. The infrastructure was destroyed. The hurricane had destroyed everything. And there were very problematic also racial relations within Puerto Rico. So at the macro level, that's what the environment looked like even before the hurricane, right? And so that's what it looked like. And so what these organizations were doing, they were aware of this. When the hurricane hit, they already had in place a sort of working infrastructure where they could talk to each other, where they already had a way of organizing, a way of bringing resources together, right? And so even with the broken telecommunication infrastructure, they were able to continue to work. And so you may think, oh, this has nothing to do with information technology. Well, it does, because it tells us how the social elements, the social aspects of organizing are crucial, or even more crucial when the telecommunication is not in place, right? Or the information infrastructure is not in place, is destroyed. And that gives us an insight, right, of the role of social relations and the way we think about the problems and how we use technology. And so they were still bits and pieces of information and telecommunication and access to internet. And they were able to piece those things together. So in some cases, for example, one person had access to telephone. And with this telephone, like a landline, with this telephone, he would call the United States. And some of his Puerto Rican diaspora friends had conference call through Facebook, right? And they were able to connect. But this connection, this tinkering of the technology would not have been possible if the human infrastructure was not already in place, if they didn't have these collaborators across Puerto Rico and across the Puerto Rican diaspora. So that was sort of like the insight. So they created this organizational infrastructure that allowed them to be better than FEMA, you know, at bringing resources. And of course, they found a lot of struggle, actually. At some point, people were sending trucks of resources, water, you know, food and everything, and they were being taxed at customs, you know. So those are other things. But that's what happened, I guess, in Puerto Rico in terms of people taking matters into their own hands and using the resources and the knowledge that they had of their communities. I mean, FEMA didn't know exactly what people needed, right? It was the local kitchen, the local community kitchen, who knew what people were needing at the moment, right? Who knew how to help those people. So,
yeah. So that's the community impact engagement. It's not, I mean, I'm going to be devil's advocate here on the other side, is that it's not sustainable, which is why, you know, we're not advocating that corporations and technology does not need to invest in the community. I think what we're trying to say, and what I would like to say here, is this is why we need to be hired on those teams. The community needs to have a place at the table for these type of dynamics. And I know I've had on my other podcast, Veronica, talking about the corruption aspect, right, that does happen in some of these communities. This is where local elections and bigger elections come into play to take accountability against those folks, right? They just don't happen overnight. So again, I'm tying this all into, you know, the community has the power, right? And I think that's what you're saying as well, correct, Fatima?
Yeah. They have the power. And I think if a goal is to be noticed by a corporation or be noticed by local government, is to sort of have a strong presence already, right, at your local community. That's what's going to give them the opportunity to be noticed. However, from my research, I have learned that many of these communities don't necessarily want to be involved in a system that's discriminating them in the first place. Even though representation in these areas is important because of the history of discrimination and marginalization, many of these community members don't want to. In the case of Puerto Rico, for example, people were talking about rebuilding, right? And my participants were like, I don't want to rebuild something that was not working for me anyway, right? So yes, communities can have power if they work in their own issues and they organize at the local level and remain in a sort of small, you know, community working locally. And this makes them a little bit more sustainable, I think, and also makes them more visible to be included in the other in the other areas, even though they might not want to. I guess that's my point.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to expand upon COVID impacted our communities the most through a false narrative. I think also with the election coming up, we're a huge target again. I mean, that's my personal opinion, but I'd love to get your, from research and data, from a social aspect, what do you think about that?
So in terms of, so a couple of things that come to mind now that you mentioned COVID and, you know, what we live through as a community, right? So one is the idea of disaster capitalism, which basically is taking advantage of a disaster to incorporate more and more, you know, capitalism in a society. So in this case, yeah, corporations take advantage, right, of whatever is happening in a disaster, where it's COVID, where it's Hurricane Maria. So in the case of Maria, for example, they wanted to incorporate more legislation to promote Bitcoin, for example, right? In the case of COVID, we can see how many things change in terms of how we do business, right? How we educate people and all those things. So there was a big change, and that's not necessarily something that it's good, right? So there's always this push, I guess is what I'm trying to say. There's always this push to, from capitalist corporations to take advantage of a disaster and the vulnerability of people, right? By offering them potential solutions that are not necessarily solutions. So I think that's important to be aware, right, of things. And I think that's where awareness on in our community about inequality, social justice is very important. The other point was about the false narratives. And from my perspective, I was able, yeah, to, because I have not, I have another project going on here in Lexington with the Latinx community. And so we did ask them during COVID, you know, what kind of, where were they getting their information and what kind of information was circulating out there. And there were definitely a lot of false narratives. Why? Because one, from my research, there are huge, of course, we know that, right? There are huge information outlets out there, right? On TV, like major chains. And those cover, they try to cover all the Latinx community. And we are so diverse, and each community in each state has its own particularities, their own, its own needs, right? That these media outlets that are so big, they cannot cover, they don't address. So that is one thing. The other thing that was happening is that in each state, in each city, the Latinx community, we tend to have our own media outlets. The problem is that many of them are struggling big time, especially the ones that offer, you know, journalism, good journalism, or who have very good information standards, or they want to focus on community information. Those are struggling. And so they don't get a lot of money, they don't get advertisers and so forth. Sometimes, in some cases, they are community radios, which are not commercial at all. And so the Latinx communities in those areas, they don't get very specific, very good quality information tailored to their specific needs in their communities. Here in Lexington, for example, we have a community, is one of the very few community radio stations in the country in Spanish, right? And they are wonderful. But it's a struggle for them to keep on. There was a newspaper, but it closed because, you know, nobody was advertising in there. So there was this big gap of information. And then there's another radio station. Oh, so the problem with the community radio station is that it stays within the coverage area. It's just the city. And the Latinx community live outside of the city. So they don't have the resources yet to expand. So that is what is happening. So this is all context to explain a little bit that people were relying on their loved ones, on their churches, on, yeah, their friends for information, right? Because the places that are reliable either didn't provide the information tailored to their needs, or the places that provide the information, they have lack of resources, right? And so they were using social media. They were using TikTok. Social media, in a way, repeats or simulates the word of mouth way of communication, right? And so the fact that you can easily send or resend, you know, a video to a friend makes it spreadable and viral. And so they were using a lot of TikTok. They were using a lot of WhatsApp. And for me as a researcher, it was a challenge, for example, to understand what kind of messages they were sharing in WhatsApp, because it's encrypted, which is a good way, it's a good thing, right? But if I don't belong to a group, to a particular group of or community in WhatsApp, I don't have access to that information. So it's hard for me to study that. I do know that people were relying a lot on social media and particularly WhatsApp to communicate information, unfortunately, misinformation about COVID. And in this sense, these companies definitely have a lot of power, and they could potentially help a lot, but they remain in a position where that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. And that's one thing people have to understand, is it's just mimicking behaviors. So if there's a fear, if someone starts a rumor of fear about a vaccine or about what's coming in the election through a deep fake, right? It's like, how do you check, right? How do you check if it's real, right? And the one thing I say is, where is the information coming from? The origination, right? Is it from like the global news wires, right? Like, can you go to BBC or Al Jazeera or to CNN or to the New York Times, to any of these big, big outlets that have their finger on the pulse? And if it hits there, that's what I say, it's pretty much a thing. But if it's on someone's TikTok or if it's on someone's, you know, X page, and it's like, oh my God, something's on fire, you know, do you see it popping up on any of the big news wires? Because the big news wires, and I'm not talking about the furry animal TV station, which shall be nameless here, but we know what that is, right? If you can all guess. If it hits there too, it's like, what are they saying? So there's a lot of decryption, right? We have to think for ourselves and not get too, you know, because what is the control that we have, right? It's like, are we going to spread it before we know it? Or are we going to take the time to evaluate it to make sure we're not harming more people? I mean, that's kind of how I look at the information kind of distribution today, right? The deep fakes, because that's what's coming with AI. So do you want to talk a little bit about, I mean, I know you're not an expert in that, but it does have components to data curation, where the data gets distributed, how people analyze it. I don't even know if people analyze it. They're just quick to hit the share button. You know what I mean? And especially if people tell you, reshare this, you know, it's like, that's an immediate no. Immediate, right? That's an immediate no. I'm trying to tell people, because I've been on a couple of these how to spot deepfakes by, you know, big organizations through the DC and Washington, DC, and to really help like not spread a fire that is necessary, right?
So I think yes, it's becoming increasingly, it's going to become increasingly difficult to figure out, even for, you know, those of us who have a little bit more experience with information technology. But one thing that I think helps explain a little bit, you know, why people may rely on a TikTok video more than something from the government is because of the long history that Latino, Latinx community have of marginalization and mistreatment. There's been a long history of that, but also, for example, not only on information side, but also on the health side. So I know, for example, that many Guatemalan immigrants or Guatemalan people were wary of the vaccine, for example, and were more prone to listen to misinformation related to the vaccine, because the government in the, I think it was the 80s, conducted experiments in Guatemalan people, and they injected them with syphilis, right? And so why would you trust an official source when they have done this to you, right? So I think that helps explain in part some of the stuff that's up. Also, as an immigrant, why would you trust, you know, an official source if the police or ICE is constantly harassing you? Why would you trust them if, for example, you go to the DMV to get your driver's license and they treat you poorly? So in part, that explains a little bit why we tend to trust a loved one who sends us a link than the official channels. And so I guess this area is still being studied in my field. One of the insights that I do have from my research is precisely the fact that people avoid searching for official channels because they have had previous almost traumatic experiences in official channels, right? And so that is a type of information behavior or information practice where people are trying to protect themselves, even if the outcome is not necessarily conducive to you getting the best information possible, right? So yeah, that's one aspect that might help explain why we go into these sources rather than other sources. There are all these social elements, right? And in our experience that go beyond whether we have skills in curated information.
Yeah, I think it's a great starting point because, I mean, we're already behind, but I think the critical years have passed for a big change. I mean, I would say these last two decades have been so pivotal in so many ways of race, technology, and just global shifts, you know, and it's always happening. But I think it impacts us more because we're closer to the technology, because we hold it in our hand every day. It like lives with us. It is more connected to us than, you know, many of our relatives, right? I mean, on a serious note. So, Fatima, I love all the things we're talking about today. So one of the things that, you know, I mean, it all sounds like gloom and doom, like, oh my God, but there are solutions for us to look to. And there is a call to action, you know, like, what do you think the long-term, you know, implications are if we don't have solutions? Or should we look to solutions within the community that can increase? I think we're doing that today. You talk about an archive. I hope this becomes an archive of education and awareness around technology. In fact, that is my whole North Star, which is why you're here. So can you bring us into that? Like, what would be the solutions and, you know, an impact that we can have as a community? Because it's so important for all of us to learn from at this critical point.
Yeah. So the cases I've studied, particularly the case of Puerto Rico, is not unique. I mean, you can see this wherever there is a disaster, wherever there's a crisis, you see people, you know, working together. And because of that, I think it's possible to sort of replicate that type of organizational infrastructure. I mean, it's possible to replicate that way of working. And so you could do it with your communities. You could start working together. It's more effective than waiting for the government because they come and tell you what to do, or even a big corporation, they come and tell you what to do, assuming that you don't know. You are the expert of your community. You know what are the needs. You have also skills, right? You and your friends and your family members and your neighbors, you all have skills. You all have knowledge about your community. You're all experts in your barrios, right? So it's possible to sort of recreate this thing and engage on a community level. Now, whenever there's on the flip side, right, if there's a government initiative, if there's a corporate initiative, by all means, you know, go for it. But I would suggest ensure that is community driven. Ensure that your voices are actually going to be heard in those initiatives. If they are talking about partnership, make sure that it's actually a partnership between the community and whatever organization is going on. So if there's something that, I'm learning from, you know, this research is the power that communities have to address their own problems and the power that they eventually get when they become effective in engaging in other types of realms.
Yep. So with that, I want to thank you for being with us today, Fatima. Is there anything else around the technology and accessibility you'd like to leave us with here moving forward? And where can people find you?
Okay, so even though we talk about information technology, this is my research, I'm pretty sure you've noticed I'm talking more about organizing people's behavior and structures, right? And so what I would like for people to go with is the idea that the power dynamics, the social dynamics are extremely important. Understanding those is extremely important in us understanding the way technology is applied and works in society, right? So if you want to understand a phenomenon related to technology, understand first, you know, what are the social elements going on there in terms of equality, power, and so forth. So I would say if you want to understand that, do that. In terms of where you can find me, you can Google me, Fatima K. Espinosa. I have my papers are in Google Scholar. You should be able to find me at the University of Kentucky, the College of Communication website. And my personal website is f.espinosavasquez.org, I think. you can easily Google me. As long as you write Fatima Espinosa Vasquez, because there's so many Fatima Espinosas out there.
But there's only one of you that's on my podcast. So there you go.
Thank you, Fatima, for joining us today on Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom. If you'd like to learn more about Fatima, you can find her website at fespinosavasquez.com. where she has her research, her teachings, and also all of the information that we discussed today on the podcast.
If you'd like to learn more about Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.com and sign up for our newsletter, where you'll find out more about events, workshops, and webinars that we'll be hosting throughout the year with our podcast guests and allies that wish to share their information and platforms that they are building today or policies that they are creating to help transform the nation for a better democracy. If you'd like to learn more about how you can work with Latinas from the Block to the Boardroom in a sponsorship opportunity or networking event, please reach out to us at info@latinasb2b.com.
This podcast was produced by Teresa E. Gonzalez of 5E Leadership and Marketing, and also co-produced and engineered by Robert Lopez of Crates Audio.
Gracias.